Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail. Here are your hosts, Trent Kling and Leighton Kling.
Welcome to this edition of the Retail Focus Podcast with Trent and Leighton Kling. Hope everyone had a good Cyber Monday. That's something we'll talk about a little bit later in the show, is Cyber Monday performance for certain retailers. We're also going to talk about Ross and Dollar Tree, each of whom had earnings calls this week, and we'll wrap up the show by discussing a new report that suggests the perception of Victoria's Secret may be changing for the better. We'll talk about how that may impact their November sales as well. A reminder to like us and rate us wherever you do listen to us. And as always, we're available at retailpodcast@gmail.com. Also, at Retail Podcast on both Instagram and Twitter. So we begin with third quarter earnings, which came in for Dollar Tree this week. Shares rose 6% as the retailer remained steady. Nothing mind-blowing here, but again, Dollar Tree is a business we love to check up on. In this week's case, we wanted to check up on it simply because of margins and costs, because Dollar Tree, as we've discussed in the past, one of the best retailers in this space at squeezing margins out of their merchandise, particularly on the Dollar Tree side. Hasn't been so much the case with the Family Dollar side, but the Dollar Tree side. So with all this talk of tariffs and increasing costs, we felt like this earnings call was a crucial one to cover, and it could help paint a picture for the next year or more for the retailer, for whom net income hit $281.8 million. That's up nearly $42 million year over year.
Yeah, and earnings per share also rose about around 15% for the company, and their $1.18 per share mark bested analyst expectations by around 4 cents per share. Sales hit $5.54 billion. Sounds like a lot of money. It's because it is, but it still missed Wall Street marks by around $10 million, but increasing around 4% year over year. This was due to having more stores and more sales per store. They opened around 127 new locations, closed just 18 stores for the quarter, switched over, by the way, Trent, to your previous remark, 30 Family Dollar stores to Dollar Tree stores because those Dollar Tree stores are performing better in certain markets. Same store sales for the company overall, so this includes the aggregate of Family Dollar and Dollar Tree stores, they grew 1%, mostly a function of the stronger Dollar Tree outlets, though, because Family Dollar is still showing signs of weakness. Family Dollar store comps, so just Family Dollar by themselves, waned around 0.4%. Dollar Tree branded stores saw comps rise 2.3% against a strong 5% comp that they reported in the third quarter of last year. Corporate Dollar Tree stores, those comps grew for the 43rd straight quarter. So we're talking about that 1% mark. And we've been seeing around 1% to 2% for quite some time. You really have to scratch your head and wonder if in 2019 or fiscal 2019 for Dollar Tree, if we won't see that streak broken. But since Dollar Tree bought Family Dollar, they have opened 830 new Family Dollar stores and renovated almost just as many. Around 800 have been renovated. They have closed around 200 and rebranded 354 of those Family Dollar stores to Dollar Tree. And to your point, you know, Family Dollar, they keep on struggling, but they feel, management feels like the new Family Dollar stores, all of the ones that you see popping up right now in those larger metropolitan areas, namely Georgia and parts of the Midwest. Throughout the call, they mentioned how their different investments have really started to pay off, and they're confident in the cleaner, often newer stores that the customers are changing their perception. It's not going to be an overnight process, and I think this is important because a lot of analysts are talking about how Family Dollar needs to be respun off after just being acquired not that long ago by Dollar Tree, and I think that it is maybe a short-sighted response because they are investing heavily in the brand, and to see comps fall by 0.4% is not too alarming for the brand. Costs, even though earnings beat and gap net margins were healthier than last year, Trent, the company gave public signs that profit potential could possibly dissipate going forward.
And this is exactly kind of what we led off the story with, why we wanted to cover this earnings call in the first place. I do want to reference that Family Dollar note that you made. A lot of analysts talking about potentially re-spinning off Family Dollar. But again, some of the renovations in Family Dollar locations are only now taking place. And we have seen a bit of a turnaround when it comes to same store sales. Also, Dollar Tree is getting that opportunity to really choose where they're putting new Family Dollar stores. those new Family Dollar stores, helping to increase the overall profitability of the brand. But let's talk about those costs. Higher freight expenses, wage growth, and the cost of goods sold, all real hindrances right now for the company. Gross margins narrowed to 30.2% of sales. This is a function of a few things. Relatively high shrink, markdowns on the Family Dollar side, of course, at Dollar Tree, not a big opportunity for markdowns since everything's already a dollar. But here's the key, store rent. This is what Leighton and I keep referring to when we're talking about rent costs going up for retailers. There's a lot of retailers out there that are talking about decreasing rent costs. That's not at least the experience of a lot of REITs in the marketplace. It's not the experience that we've seen with a lot of other retailers. And here, Dollar Tree, very transparent in that store rent continues to rise. This is something they've been mentioning now for the last 3 years on these earnings calls. Markdowns, by the way, we should mention consisted of damaged goods. So that's where the Dollar Tree factor comes in. But promotional pricing as well for Family Dollar. So clearance and sales, in other words, for the Family Dollar branch. Corporate costs, however, decreased as the company has streamlined support centers. Again, this was expected to happen as you continue to realize those synergies between Family Dollar and Dollar Tree since the Family Dollar integration. And support centers has been one area that the company has been slow to address since that integration, but now they're beginning to reap some of the benefits. Now, despite cost pressures, CEO Gary Philbin is confident in his company's ability going forward to deliver a differentiated and defensible business model. So differentiated for the consumer and defensible to those same analysts that Leighton was discussing. The idea being that dollar stores will always be able to have competitive price points and therefore selection versus online merchants who have to use low-cost items as sometimes add-on options for larger orders to mitigate the burden of shipping costs will help to differentiate. Also, the idea behind Family Dollar really kind of stems from that convenience store that is also a variety store. Same thing that we're seeing now with Dollar General. Dollar General has been branding themselves as kind of the new hometown variety store there. Family Dollar, we're seeing much the same thing. We're seeing a lot of Family Dollar and Dollar Tree locations, both in rural areas that honestly are underserved by processes that can get you same-day delivery or next-day delivery or buy online pickup in-store options. So there is a differentiation there. And let's face it, a lot of rural areas, and I've lived in one parts of my life, they are not going to be top of mind for a lot of retailers, but this is where Dollar Tree as a whole, and also Dollar General to some extent, feels as though they can differentiate themselves by focusing on the rural areas that are underserved and creating that value proposition for those consumers in those areas.
And to your earlier point, Trent, they have to basically act as a variety store in a lot of these markets. And because of that, they have a strong market with discretionary goods. So if you go into a Dollar Tree or even a Family Dollar, it is not all about consumables or the items that you may need in health and beauty, but often toys and other products that you don't necessarily need on a week-to-week basis come into play. And I think that was really a strong category for them in the third quarter overall for the company as a whole. So Dollar Tree corporate benefited in terms of category strength from discretionary goods. And what's interesting is on the call, they specifically noted that Halloween sold well, perhaps taking advantage of retailers that either struggled to meet larger expectations, like with Party City. We talked about on their earnings call how Halloween sold well, but maybe not up to management expectations for that retailer, or how certain retailers were out of the Halloween business altogether. Think of retailers that went out of business and filed bankruptcy, like Toys R Us. So those costumes, those gadgets that are under $5 that are sold during the Halloween time of year, those were options for Family Dollar and Dollar Tree, and they really tried to take advantage of those categories. Their Hallmark greeting card partnership is said to be successful. This was a partnership, Trent, that was talked about earlier in the year, but was only initiated during the summer of this year. And honestly, this is something that was thought about as sort of a tool to rebrand some of their stores, elevate their brand, if you will, because Hallmark greeting cards, they sort of are looked at as the staple greeting card in that particular industry. So this was an in-store collaboration of sorts, and this was initiated, like I said, a few months ago, but you're looking at parts of the store that are really segmented out to where you have the Hallmark branded greeting card section. They take over a whole half aisle of the store, and they said that this has really been successful in bringing traffic to the store. And Another thing that's said to be boosting traffic also is what they call snack zones in their Dollar Tree branded stores, a new feature in over 800 stores where small areas of snacks are placed strategically around the stores, particularly on end caps or pods. And this is helping to boost the consumables category, and their selection has seemed a bit more diverse, and we're talking about consumables here, with both Family Dollar and Dollar Tree. I recently visited a Family Dollar. I was surprised at just how much space in terms of the overall square footage that consumables were taking up, and this was a newer location, and they had a large section of refrigerated goods. And even in Dollar Tree banners, you see them really having more success with the refrigerated areas of their store. And as for those areas in Dollar Tree stores, they said they now have over 5,500 locations with either freezers or coolers. So that's a lot of stores to be really rolling those out in. And honestly, I am really surprised, happily surprised for the brand to have so much of a diverse selection with their food. But their e-commerce division, switching gears here a little bit, for Dollar Tree, named Dollar Tree Direct, grew from the bottom line perspective. Management said they are growing slowly, but they are still making really positive strides. They were actually able to further leverage the Hallmark greeting card partnership there. So not only an in-store type of partnership, but also something that goes into the digital sphere. By the end of the quarter, they operated 15,187 stores. We're talking about both the Dollar Tree and Family Dollar banners together in 48 states, and they operate in 5 Canadian provinces. In fiscal 2019, they want to open 550 stores with about a 65-35 mix between, you guessed it, Dollar Tree being the two-thirds mark and the one-third being the Family Dollar. The company lowered revenue guidance for the full fiscal year, and they narrowed earnings per share expectations, meaning that they raised the bottom end and lowered the top end guidance. Earnings per share figures don't reflect, however, the company's ongoing store investments. So they consider those to be one-time expenses, something you have to really take into consideration, especially as in 2019, looking forward to that guidance, they're opening so many stores. Shares of Dollar Tree, DLTR, ended Friday at $86.77 per share, down 20% year-to-date when shares were over $115 a share in January. Mid-January, they hit that mark. Bigger drops than spikes this year if you look at the one-year graph, as the company has more or less stayed the course, meeting internal guidance but not really making any massive moves to make people excited about owning the stock. Some are still critical of the Family Dollar acquisition, like Trent had noted, like I had noted, but certainly have taken a massive chunk of market share in the U.S. as a whole. So as an American retailer, as a retailer that does a lot of business in North America, I believe that Dollar Tree is a great company, but to their previous remarks, management's concerned about the profitability in the years to come. I think that could spike some fears with that stock as well. Also, inflation, something we really have to consider, particularly in the Dollar Tree banner.
Well, we talk about TJ Maxx plenty when it comes to the off-price space, especially when it comes to earning calls. So it's only right that we discuss their surging competitor in Ross this week, as Ross released their earnings on actually the same day as TJ Maxx. Unlike with the lighter than expected revenues at Dollar Tree, Ross was able to beat on both top and bottom line. Earnings per share of 91 cents beat by 1 cent per share and beat the top end of company guidance by 3%. Revenue for Ross was up a healthy 6.6% to $3.549 billion, which served also as a minor beat over analyst expectations, and that key same-store sales metric rose 3%, which is actually slightly less than what we were expecting, but better than the modest company goal of 1-2% comp growth. We felt that 1-2% goal was a little bit thin, maybe a little bit of sandbagging going on there. But same-store sales, as we mentioned, did rise 3% for the most recent quarter. This was a function of both more customers per store and higher basket combined together. So it's good to see that it's not just from one or the other. We like retailers when their same-store sales are increasing to show both more traffic and higher ticket prices as well, or higher basket, as they call it in this case. Input costs for merchandise, though, this is once again why we're talking about this call on this podcast, as it was with Dollar Tree. Input costs for merchandise are seeing the effects of a tighter, more competitive market, more physical off-price locations, something we've talked about in the past, is going to drive competition up for those goods, meaning input costs could be a little bit higher. And relative to sales, we did see that in this last quarter, as cost of goods sold rose 60 basis points for Ross. Selling and administrative costs also rose, but by a much more modest 30 basis points. Now, Ross management made it a point during the earnings call to mention trucking problems. This is something we're hearing actually quite a bit from when it comes to logistics. A lot of people are having issues finding A, logistics at the same prices they were getting prior, and B, just the number of drivers that they need to conduct their fleet with an increasing number of stores. Ross has expanded by leaps and bounds over the last 5 years, and a shortage of drivers, as well as, to an extent, fuel costs increasing, has driven up the price to transport merchandise. So between the actual costs of the goods that they're selling and transportation and logistics, not a great thing on the bottom line for Ross, even though, once again, beating analyst expectations on that front. And while admitting that store personnel wage hikes certainly were a real thing in 2018 and a real impact on their bottom line, they wouldn't comment on any strategic plans for wage investment in 2019, other than to say that both wages and trucking expenses were expected to rise in some form or fashion. We would think, based on what we're hearing from other retailers, trucking expenses may actually outpace wages in that category. Management did say that freight, incredibly hard to predict. Different regions of the U.S. experience certainly different dynamics that affect trucking expenses, labor availability, that type of thing. Among them, labor availability being one such factor, but regulation is something that's not mentioned much, but moving freight is harder and harder now with an increasing number of rules on truckers and the trucks themselves. Trucking costs overall, to help paint the overall picture, that 30,000-foot picture, were up a whopping 20% for Ross year over year when you compare this year so far in 2018 back to 2017.
CEO Barbara Rentler said that the positive points overall for her came from beating sales expectations. And if you look, Trent, in a number of markets, they beat their internal guidance. Florida, she said, and the Midwest markets in particular did really, really well. Men's category, that was the best for the company overall. It's something that I was actually surprised about. I went into a Ross over last weekend, and it was very, very busy. Busier than the TJ Maxx that it sat beside. But to be honest with you, Trent, I did not see a lot of people perusing the men's section. However, housewares, home goods, and women's were all having high amounts of traffic. It does seem as though, and this matched up with my own expectation of the store, it seems as though they want to prepare stores for the influx of customers over the last month and continuing on into December. So as a result, inventories per store were up 9% at the end of the quarter. And this is something that you and I look at oftentimes when we cover earnings calls, Trent, that inventory number, that inventory per store number, it being up 9%, that seemed like a lot. And this was actually something that an analyst pointed out on the Q&A, and they asked about it, and they responded in such a way that alluded to the idea that they were anticipating customers having more money to spend, more discretionary funds, and they'd be willing to at least spend more for the holiday. So relative to income or not, they expected that people would be opening up their wallets a little bit more, and they really wanted to fill their stores up with plenty of inventory. And that is one thing. If I really had to step back and say what the big difference was for me besides the traffic count between Ross and TJ Maxx and my own personal experience, Trent, it would be that of, you know what, Ross's store was much fuller. They were ready for this influx of traffic, and I think they were really able to capitalize that for the quarter. And to be honest with you, the markdowns, let's say they don't move out as much inventory in the next month or month and a half, that's okay, because honestly, their business model is predicated upon the idea that at some point, certain categories or certain items within categories are going to have to be marked down or clearance. And that's okay, because they're buying items for relatively cheap, and they are confident in their brick and mortar presence and their current off-price strategy in the face of competition. They said that they are favorably competitive with other banners, both online and physical retailers, which really brings to question the idea that a lot of their product categories, or a lot of what they have in home goods, actually can compete with online retailers. Because to our previous story in Dollar Tree and Family Dollar, a lot of those cheaper items just doesn't make sense for online retailers to sell them. unless they're an add-on item because of those shipping costs. They did benefit from store closures, they said, from other retailers, probably some of the retailers we've talked about on this very podcast that have filed bankruptcy in the recent past, but they were able to get more items because of this. They were able to actually do what a lot of other retailers does, think of Big Lots, buying a lot of merchandise from retailers that are struggling or going out of business entirely. And as a result, they were actually able to reduce some of the items that they're bringing to their stores, those input costs, by around 20 basis points. So this is interesting. Again, think back to Ollie's Bargain Outlet, which is one of our favorite retailers. In this regard, where higher inventories per store is not necessarily a bad thing if the items purchased were bought at rock bottom prices. Direct costs from buying goods, like I said, went down 20 basis points in the quarter, but this is offset, like what Trent had mentioned, by trucking and logistics expense. So this is sort of trying to play a balance game. You have a lot of other costs on the administrative side. However, some of the products you're bringing in are a little bit cheaper. So it's kind of a tug and war. I'm very curious to see what the relatively low gas prices right now. The fuel prices in the US are down significantly for the holidays, despite record number of families traveling. Very curious to see how this helps a lot of different retailers, specifically Ross in this case. Going into December, the company is foreshadowing tough comps because of such a strong 2017. Remember back in 2017, everyone was saying that Ross is the future of retail because they're opening so many locations throughout the United States and they were extremely bullish in their business model. But as a result, we saw same store sales 4 or 5%, made us wonder, are they going to keep that momentum going forward? And we thought they were sandbagging when they had guidance of 1 to 2% same store sales in the United States. They still expect positive same store sales, but are still keeping that 1 to 2% conservative figure. And that, I think, makes a lot of investors wary.
Earnings per share for the full year is now expected to be higher in part thanks to a resolved tax issue. Now, at the end of the third quarter, Ross did have 1,720 stores, including 237 dd's discount locations. They opened 30 new Ross stores and 10 dd's discounts. And actually, on a trip I made a couple of weeks ago, I noted a new shopping center that had a Ross right next to a dd's discount. So they're not afraid of basically opening up one store right next to the other in that circumstance. They have also been buying back shares. They repurchased 2.9 million shares in the quarter and have bought back 9.4 million shares over the trailing past 9 months. Now, speaking of those shares, Ross shares, ticker ROST, were up over 3% on Wednesday after the earnings call and closed Friday at $87.60. However, all-time highs just back in November of over $103 a share, like with Dollar Tree, they've probably seen some backing off simply because of the overall market volatility we've seen over the last month and a half. Shares, however, are up nearly 140% over the last 5 years. They have a market cap of $32.7 billion, or as we like to compare market caps to, about 60 times that of JCPenney. A price-to-earnings ratio of 21 times, suggesting some optimism still going forward for those new stores and in terms of being able to maintain those crucial margins. Well, that'll do it for the first half of the Retail Focus podcast. After the music, we'll talk Cyber Monday numbers, and we'll also talk L Brands and Victoria's Secret. Well, we've got early Cyber Monday numbers, and these early numbers suggest some winners, but also a surprising step back for Jet.com. Amongst a kind of a reorganization at Jet.com by Walmart, a refocusing of their target customer. Now, these early Cyber Monday numbers come via Edison Trends, who analyzed email receipts for 3 million Americans. So these aren't comprehensive by any means. And of course, as we always add the caveat to with early data, we're not going to know the full results of Cyber Monday until we start seeing these earnings calls, in most cases, fourth quarter earnings calls by these retailers. But this is a large enough sample size to certainly be somewhat meaningful to our podcast. Now, some of these trends we probably could have guessed at. Amazon saw growth of 17% year over year, and they captured by far and away the lion's share of the market. We talked a few weeks ago about how Walmart still dwarfs Amazon in overall retail market share by sales in the U.S. But this is a powerful reminder here that Amazon is still the king of e-commerce. Amazon's market share was 72.1% for the e-commerce sales measured by Edison Trends. Note, this is only e-commerce sales, so obviously doesn't include brick and mortar during Cyber Monday, of course. But on Cyber Monday, 72.1% market share for Amazon. The next two in market share, no surprise here. Walmart coming in at 10.4% and Target at 10% even, meaning all other e-commerce competitors measured and evaluated made up a combined 7.5% of market share. And you know, this kind of took me back to some of John Kenneth Galbraith's hypothesis many years ago that only those with substantial resources have the potential to capture that future market share because of the high technological price serving as a barrier to entry. And he was talking about industry, but it certainly does also apply to e-commerce. You think about the technological barriers to entry, but also the marketing barriers to entry. Have to have a lot of money in order to do that. Something that established retailers like Walmart and Target have. Something that Amazon, who got into the game a little bit early, also very much has. If, however, you break down the market share into categories, Leighton, you get a bit of a clearer look as far as the brick and mortar stores making an impact in e-commerce.
Yeah, you absolutely do. And this is something that we were excited to see because a lot of people were saying that traffic was only down or could possibly be up slightly for some retailers, but traffic overall during the Black Friday weekend was only down around 1%. And we, again, always have to remember a couple years ago when everyone said that this was a retail apocalypse for brick and mortar. But we see here, as it relates to this report, in the department store category, Macy's took 36.4% market share, the leader, and consistent with what we've seen as far as better development of all the channels for that retailer. Something they spoke about in their earnings call here recently was their omni-channel strategy and their store-within-a-store concepts for their off-price segment. However, the story may lie with Kohl's, whose market share in the category was 31.7%. Think of Kohl's as a retailer who did a lot of business here recently. Kohl's had year-over-year e-commerce Cyber Monday growth of 42%, which led all retailers studied. Nordstrom, with 20.9% market share in this category, saw 33% growth. Macy's growth, for what it's worth, was up 30% year over year. JCPenney's market share in the category was around 9.8%, though they saw a decline in a different key metric, which brings us to average ticket, which saw a dramatic increase for some retailers, but also a decrease for others. Nordstrom, for example, had the highest cost per order increase of around 12% per ticket. Nordstrom, a brand that is elevated such that they can actually raise prices, and as a result, you see not a lot of promotional activity and customers paying full price for a lot of their items in store. JCPenney, however, saw a decline of around 10%, never a good sign, even if promotional pricing activity drove up traffic for that retailer. Because, as we mentioned in the past, if there's one retailer that cannot afford a margin cut due to promotional pricing, it's probably JCPenney. They did too much of that early on. They've switched strategies a number of times, and now they have a high debt burden to have to address. It's not going to be a healthy quarter for JCPenney if they continue that trend. Target saw a modest or more modest decrease in ticket size, around 5%. Again, likely caused by promotional activity mentioned by the company itself in the lead up to the big retail event. Brian Cornell, their CEO, mentioned the necessity of cutting prices in order to remain competitive in the e-commerce space during their last earnings call. Also mentioned was a ton of free shipping discounts. That is not free for the company, and this was a driver of eroded margins. Amazon's ticket size, by the way, increased around 3%, really indicating that customers are still going in droves to that platform, but they are just not buying perhaps as much as some people were expecting.
However, the lead of the story when we first started was about Jet.com, as they saw a massive decline in Cyber Monday sales. Part of this could be chalked up to an inevitable marketing cannibalization as Walmart prioritized its own e-commerce marketing initiatives in the run-up to Cyber Monday and actually the week prior to Cyber Monday. However, part of Jet's appeal has increasingly been regular orders of consumables, particularly for those in larger metro areas, which isn't exactly something Cyber Monday is really known for. You're looking at larger purchases, but even still, a good portion of Jet.com is geared towards things like electronics, gifts, household appliances and other large purchases of that ilk. Anyhow, Jet.com saw a decrease of 39% year over year on Cyber Monday. Jet's losses in market share may be offset somewhat by Walmart's gains. As Edison noted, Walmart saw e-commerce gains of 67% year over year in the week leading up to Thanksgiving. Jet.com's revenue for that same week dropped 57%, but Walmart's own Cyber Monday growth was 32%. And given the much larger volume Walmart.com sees versus Jet.com, let's face it, Walmart.com does trump a lot of other retailers, including their own holding and Jet.com's makeup for the falling sales at Jet.com. Now, several analysts did wonder about Jet.com's future after the Walmart purchase, especially with Mark Lohr receiving a major role at Walmart, kind of spurred some other speculation that Jet.com may eventually be the odd e-commerce site out in terms of Walmart's increasing e-commerce portfolio. But a Jet.com rep did tell Retail Dive regarding these numbers that Walmart has been in the process of repositioning Jet to a more complementary role, something we referenced at the beginning of this story. Increased focus on cities, especially larger metro areas where Walmart's presence is thin. Think Seattle, Washington as one example. Now, this had previously been announced in September, although it's hard for us to believe that any such repositioning would have that quickly had such a large impact on e-commerce sales and such a big drop year over year. The overall takeaway for Walmart as a company, as a whole, when you take them and Jet.com together, at least according to this research, is that their e-commerce sales increases appear in line with what they've seen already this year, anywhere between 30 and 50% increases, likely to see that also for this quarter going ahead. So mostly promising news taken as a whole for retail. I should mention, out of the retailers that were measured and specified in this Edison Trends report, only Sears, in addition to Jet.com, had falling sales year over year, and even Sears only fell by a couple of percentage points in that circumstance. So that's why it raised a lot of eyebrows, but again, overall suggestive of a very strong retail climate so far this holiday season.
For our last story, we will talk about a new report from YouGov that suggests perceptions of Victoria's Secret may be changing for the better. This is ultimately good news, where good news has been difficult to come by for the long-standing banner under L Brands. And for some time now, L Brands has sought to really answer to flagging same-store sales, including removing marketing channels like their catalog and coupon mailers that we talked about on this podcast over a year ago, bringing those channels back, eliminating swimwear, and much, much more. Management is sort of all over the place, if you will, in terms of trying to realign their strategy. If you guess that these eliminations did little to spur sales, you would be correct. Many of their changes have been really to attempt to boost margins, and L Brands also cut their dividend back after the third quarter and announced the 2019 closure of one of their brands. But sales have fallen so precipitously that any attempts to save margins have been futile. In fact, operating income as a percentage of sales plummeted versus their second quarter of this fiscal year from 11.1% in 2017 to 6.6% in 2018. This while Bath & Body Works attained operating income as a percentage of sales of around 17.5%, a retailer that for L Brands has been doing much, much better than Victoria's Secret. Comp sales fell 6% year over year in the third quarter for Victoria's Secret, while sales including e-commerce fell 2%, indicating that Victoria's Secret e-commerce business is not too strong compared to other retailers that are really investing in the space heavily. Bath & Body increased by a notable 10% in the same-store sales category and 13% in the overall comp sales, which of course we're talking about digital. As a result of their suboptimal third quarter earnings call, L Brands stock hit a 30-day low of around $28.43 per share on November 20th, just prior to Black Friday. It has since rebounded to close around $33.11 per share at the end of this week. But Trent, signs of a potential turnaround were there on Black Friday for the retailer. And to be honest with you, this is one of the retailers I personally surveyed, if you could call it a survey. I went to a couple local malls, and you know what? Traffic was pretty sturdy, especially compared to a lot of the other retailers you tend to think about in the mall apparel space. You think of American Eagle and others.
And one listener even reached out to us to note that their mall's Victoria's Secret was perhaps the busiest store per square footage in that mall during Black Friday. The listener even noted to us that this phenomenon was being talked about by other shoppers at the mall, calling Victoria's Secret, and I quote, crazy packed. Well, something must be working at Victoria's Secret, as the research by YouGov found increased customer perception versus a similar data set in April. This comes via YouGov's Plan and Track platform. The sentiment boost was most notable among U.S. females aged 18 to 49, which is good fortune, of course, for Victoria's Secret, as this is their exact target market. So there's a few different things that YouGov measures, one of them being a brand's buzz score. We'll get to possibly more important categories here in a little bit, but the buzz score measures whether consumers have heard something, either positive or negative, about a brand in a two-week time frame. Basically just saying, hey, yes, I've heard something about this brand, or no, this brand's been completely off my radar. Well, Victoria's Secret's buzz score peaked near 29 in early October and kind of maintained it throughout November. This has been their highest buzz score since back in February of 2016, and that buzz score is nice, but the more important part might be the purchasing habits YouGov noted among the same age group. In mid-April, the number of women 18 to 49 who reported purchasing something from Victoria's Secret was down to 17%. The lowest mark since YouGov began tracking at the beginning of January 2016. However, that number has been increasing steadily since that low, popping up to levels not seen since spring of 2017, around 24%, basically saying around 24% of women 18 to 49 have reported recently purchasing something from Victoria's Secret. Now, customer satisfaction, another metric YouGov measures, has also been increasing, but more slowly than the other two metrics, than the buzz score and the number of people purchasing from Victoria's Secret, at least measured by YouGov. Once again, in April, we saw a customer satisfaction low of 29 on that customer satisfaction score. It's now up to 37, which is still off its last peak, around 40 in December of 2017. But at least this improving customer satisfaction score, Layton, shows signs that perhaps the drought for Victoria's Secret may be showing signs of abating here.
However, all of this information is still mostly speculative as to whether it will actually result in a sales increase for the company, or more importantly, an increase in operating income. This makes sense from the bottom line perspective. We'll get crucial November sales numbers for all of L Brands on December 6th, so in a relatively short period of time. So we'll see if the preliminary data and circumstantial information surrounding their Black Friday traffic are borne out in the raw numbers, something we're excited to see. Victoria's Secret would be looking at their first significant increase in same-store sales for the fall-winter season since November of 2016, when, by the way, they improved 5% over November of 2015. Pretty good. They saw mild 1% increases in September of this year, although not enough to override the August losses. And meanwhile, fun fact, the last fall-winter season year-over-year decrease for Bath & Body Works took place all the way back in November of 2013, their only negative same-store sales metric for the season since 2011. Again, we talk about that banner really having strength. Well, you can see it there. As far as the reasons for the potential turnaround for the company, if the sales numbers back up all the other evidence, we can only guess what other reasons there are. And the aforementioned listener noted that Les Wexner, CEO, has been seeing some interesting political press lately, stating that he left the Republican Party in September. YouGov noted that there's been less social media traffic surrounding the Me Too movement, but also noted that it would be difficult to prove a causal link. Our take is that they've been increasingly aggressive with going back to their couponing program that so helped the brand rise to their initial prominence. Granted, this could all be smoke and mirrors. We won't get to see operating margin until their fourth quarter is up. So even if sales numbers increase, margin may still be taking a hit.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
We've reached the final segment of the Retail Focus Podcast, a segment we call Looking Ahead, where each Layton and I choose a story that we're keeping an eye on for the next week, month, or year. We begin with Layton.
So this is a story that we don't often talk about, or at least an area of retail we don't often talk about. We have a couple times with CVS Health when they decided to stop carrying tobacco products. But Juul, a company that is huge in the e-cigarette market, is really taking a step back as far as their overall strategy. This is a company that has faced a lot of criticism, basically saying that they've tailored a lot of marketing towards kids or younger generation of adults that haven't previously smoked cigarettes. And as a result, they've been in the news a lot lately. And their whole motto previous to this was that they are not big tobacco. They're simply just trying to get people off of cigarettes into a what they call safer alternative. Well, it looks as though Juul, they are considering money, or at least taking money in a form of an investment from Altria, one of the largest stakeholders in the tobacco industry in the United States. And for critics, you know, the possibility of them coming together as one, or at least in terms of a partnership, is very head-scratching because, again, Juul, they've prided themselves on being separate from the big tobacco industry, saying that they are not that at all. They're not trying to get new users of tobacco products. And what this means for retail, we have to take a step back and understand that this is the Retail Focus podcast. There is a huge question of how this is going to be regulated going forward and how this is going to impact retailers, because e-cigarettes, a lot of big name retailers have really said, you know what, we are not going to carry these products in our store. It's a public safety concern. But a lot of the retailers that already are saying that still carry cigarettes and other tobacco products. So perhaps this is a retail story, because if this partnership bears fruit with Altria, if something happens in terms of a minority stake in the Juul company, one could really question whether or not we do start seeing these e-cigarette companies having more market share in big retail. And this is something that I think has a lot of people concerned that have been trying to fight big tobacco for years and years and years in terms of pushing back the marketing campaigns that are tailored towards kids. Well, Juul is still in that category now, because they've really taken a couple steps back and they've had to do some self-regulation in terms of who they promote their products to. And I really have to question, what is the strategy of Altria if they take a minority stake? It's not just going to be seeking profits, it's going to be expanding that particular market. So I'm curious to see a couple of things. One, how it's going to be regulated going forward. And two, what this means for big retail, because a lot of retailers, including Walgreens, a company that said, you know what, we're going to keep carrying tobacco products in our stores despite our competitors not doing so. I wonder what their take is going to be, because this is marketed as a healthier alternative. So perhaps there could be an upside for people that are already buying cigarettes or big tobacco products in traditional retail environments.
My looking ahead story is pretty straightforward. Kroger releases their latest earnings call next week. In fact, on Thursday, December 6th, you can bet we'll be talking about it on the Retail Focus podcast. Now, the earnings and the numbers are going to be interesting, but I'm going to be looking at a few other things. First of all, how are they going to talk about the next quarter? What kind of guidance are they going to release for this future quarter? And then the other aspects of what I'm going to be looking at, how they reference toys. We know toys are going to be on the tips of the tongues of a lot of analysts on this call, especially since they announced the introduction of Jeffrey's Toy Box, which Leighton mentioned on a past episode of the Retail Focus, to about 600 stores for the holiday season. Will they address that? Will they address that new warehouse we discussed recently with Ocado? What type of initiatives will they be discussing? And also, you know, Kroger earnings calls are always a great place to get information on what we're seeing as far as food inflation. And as we've talked about, we haven't seen food inflation take hold to the extent that we've seen inflation in other merchandise areas. A lot of areas of general merchandise, we've seen clothing, for example, be a little more impacted by inflation, but food has remained relatively steady outside of meat and dairy. So I want insights regarding that, and that'll give us a little bit of a window into how we should be looking at supermarkets, especially going into 2019, kind of an unknown year. Well, that'll do it for us here on the Retail Focus podcast. Once again, for Leighton, I'm Trent. Check us out online on Instagram and Twitter at Retail Podcast, also retailpodcast@gmail.com. We'll be back 1 week from now.
This has been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.